People with ADHD nervous systems are world-class problem solvers. They are out-of-the-box thinkers, and so they can take a problem that has stumped everybody else, and they can come up with the right answer.
Welcome to the ADHD Essentials Podcast. I'm your host, Brendan Mahan. I'm an ADHD professional who has been working in the field for 10 years. I'm on the organizing committee for the International Conference on ADHD and a board member of the Men's ADHD Support Group. Is there too much tension at home? Do you find yourself bossing your kid rather than leading them? The ADHD Essentials Parenting Groups can help. And registration for the Spring 2024 session is now open. These groups are built to improve the cooperation and relationships between you and your kid. We'll do that with ADHD-friendly strategies that can improve communication, support independence, and reduce the overall anxiety at home. Over the past 5 years, I've helped hundreds of parents address the challenges they face as a result of ADHD and anxiety, and I'm sure I can help you too. We'll meet for 1 hour twice a week on Mondays and Wednesdays over the course of 8 weeks. One section is at 12 p.m. Eastern and the other is at 5 p.m. Eastern. The 12 p.m. Eastern section is exclusive to parents of teens, but the 5 p.m. section is open to all parents. Check out the link in the show notes for more information and to register for a free information call. Or if you would prefer, just email me at brendan@adhdessentials.com and we'll set up a time to talk. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by Dr. William Dodson. Now semi-retired, Dr. Dodson is a board-certified adult psychiatrist and was one of the few clinicians to specialize in adults with ADHD over 25 years ago. He's been on the faculties of Georgetown University and the University of Colorado Health Sciences Center. He was the recipient of the National Maxwell Schleifer Award for Distinguished Service to Persons with Disabilities in 2006 and was named a Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Association in recognition for his clinical contributions to the field of ADHD in 2012. He's written more than 120 articles and book chapters designed to help us better understand ADHD and its treatment. In this episode, Dr. Dodson shares his interest-based nervous system approach to ADHD. We discuss how the ADHD nervous system differs from the neurotypical one and how that causes confusion and challenges when it comes to motivation. Key questions to ask about ADHD, the five general areas that support ADHD engagement, the dangers of creating urgency and chaos in order to activate, and being informed by regret and desire. Though we begin by discussing the changes he's seen in ADHD treatment over the course of his career. All right, let's get rolling.
I'm a practitioner. I've done nothing but adult ADHD for the last 25 years. I'm not a researcher, and so a lot of what I'm going to be saying is based on 25 years of clinical experience of talking to thousands of people and trying to pull together what I've learned from my patients. My very best teachers have always been my patients.
You're not a researcher, but when you've been doing this for 25 years and you've had thousands of patients, that's kind of a longitudinal study. Like it's not a formalized longitudinal study, but sort of it is.
The longest study of patients with ADHD, continuous study, is less than a year. And so they don't have the ability to see people over a long period of time, watch them grow, watch them master their ADHD, find out what works and what doesn't. And so I've had the opportunity to treat people since they were adolescents all the way to where now they're bringing in their adolescent children. So I get to follow not just individuals, but families over a long period of time. It's something that researchers just are not able to do. For them, it's publish or perish. And so most research lasts 6 to 8 weeks and done. And so they never have that longitudinal perspective.
And that's critical, that lens. I mean, I have had clients longer than that study, and I haven't been doing it nearly as long as you have been. I would love to hear, I know we're going to talk eventually about the interest-based nervous system of ADHD and sort of your view of that. But before we go there, I would just love to hear your insights from having worked with clients for such a long period of time. Are there patterns that you've noticed? Are there themes that keep coming up? What does that look like?
I got into doing ADHD work because what I was reading in books and articles and things like that, and what I was hearing from patients had virtually nothing in common. The non-medication-based therapies just weren't working. The recommendation for multimodal therapy, doing more than medication, was dropped back in 2007 when they did the last standard of care from the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. They dropped the recommendation for doing anything other than medication. Now, that tells you how poorly a lot of the research has been, the outcomes of research. It just hasn't worked. And that's exactly what I was seeing in my practice. At first, I thought, well, I was just incompetent. I just didn't know how to do it right. No, I was getting the same bad result that the people who devised these therapies were getting. And so they've come back about every 5 or 10 years, do a summary of the non-medication, more verbal therapies really having an effect on the core symptoms of ADHD. And that's a word that really, really, really needs to be emphasized. Core symptoms of ADHD. The core symptoms are inattention, impulsivity, hyperactivity or hyperarousal in adults. And now, if you're any place other than the United States, emotional dysregulation. Those are the core symptoms. And so while the talking therapies are helpful for a whole bunch of other things, they don't affect core symptoms of ADHD, the things that are really impairing.
And when you say talking therapies, are you including coaching in that? Or are you talking about like sort of the stuff we imagine that's Freudian, where you're laying on a couch and tell me about your mother and your childhood and all this stuff?
Interesting enough, coaching has never been studied. Mm-hmm. They've never had a long-term study of whether or not coaching helps or doesn't. My suspicion is that it does. But when you look back at cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, neurofeedback retraining, vitamins, diets, you know, one thing after another, none of them in blinded conditions have been able to show positive outcomes.
As a fellow practitioner, not a researcher, I can tell you that folks I work with in my coaching practice seem to be having pretty good results. I haven't parted ways with too many of them because they weren't meeting with success in working with me. It's happened and I find them someone else. But the folks I work with, they either get the results they want and move on or stick with me because they're getting the results they want. So coaching's doing something, at least in my experience.
But again, there's no money to test it. Right. The money for testing medication comes from drug companies and the fact that they have to meet FDA standards and stuff like that. That's where the money is. There is no money there to study. And again, it would need to be a long-term study for coaching. My very strong suspicion is that it's going to work great, but as yet there's no proof of it. Again, a lot of what I talk about in terms of an interest-based nervous system is how to make coaching and those therapies work better.
Yeah, and let's go there. What do you mean by interest-based nervous system?
I'm real big on asking the right questions. The presentations I give in Europe are basically saying, you know, they're six very fundamental questions that we should have been asking and haven't. And the second one is, and this is something that your clients can ask themselves and answer in their own mind right now. Look back over your entire life, dredge up all the memories you can. If you've been able to get engaged and stay engaged with literally any task of your life, have you ever found anything you could not do? If you look at the history of ADHD, there are these long lists of things that people with ADHD try to do and can't do. And then the therapies demand that they do it. And then they're surprised when they're not able to do it. That's why the therapies have done so poorly. But if you ask most people who have an ADHD nervous system, what they'll say is, if I can get engaged and stay engaged, if I can overcome procrastination and get started and stay started, I've never found anything I wasn't able to do.
Mm-hmm.
People with ADHD are remarkably capable people in the right circumstance. So the problem with ADHD is it's almost entirely situational. It depends on what the situation is. So if you look at people who are neurotypical, the other 90% of people out there walking the earth, their nervous systems work on two things, importance and rewards or consequences, consequences for not doing the task. That's how they organize and motivate themselves. And it's a very advantageous nervous system because people who have a neurotypical importance-based nervous system are able to prioritize. They are able to use other people's importance. I mean, if you look at schools, for instance, their exercises in secondhand importance. What does the teacher think is important enough to teach and important enough to put on the test? Because it's important that you know this for the course that follows along next year. Mm-hmm. If you ask a person with ADHD, look back over your entire life, can you remember a single time in which the importance of the task has actually helped you? You smiled. People with ADHD said, no, are you kidding me? No, never. For me, the importance of the task is nothing but a nag. I know what's important. I like rewards. I don't like consequences, but they've never once actually helped me get started, get access to my abilities, and stick with the task all the way to the payoff. Not once.
Yeah.
And so the very things organize and motivate everybody else that every school is built on, and about 90% of jobs are built on, importance, rewards, and consequences, are nothing but a nag to people with ADHD. It just doesn't work.
Even more than that, like I feel like nag is a really light word that you're using, right? Like, because for me, the more important something is, depending on who it's important for, like you mentioned it's situational based, right? I'm a guy who, if I'm doing something that is really important in the eyes of other folks, right? Like if I'm going to be judged based on how well or not well I do this, that's going to undermine me as often as it's going to motivate me, right? I've said to people that I have a very strong tendency, it's not on purpose, but I have a very strong tendency I've learned to meet the expectations of others. And what I mean by that is if I've got someone who is like, yeah, no, you're going to be amazing at this. You're going to do a great job. Go do that thing. I'm like, cool. I'm going to be amazing at this. And off I go and I do a great job. On the other hand, if I have someone with an attitude of like, you're just going to suck at this. It's going to be terrible. Go do it. Right. It could be the same task. It could be the exact same task that I did with the other guy. And their sort of dismissiveness or negative lens on what I can and can't do, it's not that I'm going to intentionally perform badly. What happens is my anxiety kicks in because I don't feel like they believe in me and I feel like they're setting me up for failure. My anxiety kicks in and then I do a bad job. And I've done a lot of work on that and I'm better at it now. So this is more me kind of like 10, 20 years ago. But man, until I figured that out, that undid me in all kinds of situations. Is that in here somewhere or is this just a Brendan thing?
Yeah, people fulfill expectations and they'll do for other people stuff that they won't do for themselves. People with ADHD have tremendous integrity. They will show up and do the job for somebody else that they wouldn't do for themselves. So there are basically five general areas that we've found that people with ADHD are able to engage, get access to their abilities, and get things done. And the big one is interest. If they're interested, if they're fascinated by what they're doing, they can get it done. They can get started. They can get access to their abilities and do absolutely marvelous things. In fact, that's what we call it an interest-based nervous system, is that's really the big one. And if you ask most people, you know, you go back for your 10 or 20-year high school reunion and you ask somebody, what was your high school experience like? 9 out of 10 people will go, oh, God, it was boring. It was terribly boring. Well, boring is the opposite of being interesting. And so that's one of the biggest problems with high school, especially, where you really get to choose what you're interested in the way you do in college. That's the hardest part. The person can do the task. The problem is they can't start the task.
Yep.
And so these are ways that people initiate. They overcome procrastination and then stick with it. The second big one after interest or fascination is competition or competitiveness. If somebody goes to you, "Oh, Brendan, you can't do that." If there's a part of you that goes, "Oh yeah, watch me." Whatever the task was, I don't care what it was, you'll have it mastered by the end of the day. If you accept the challenge, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Third one is novelty, doing something completely new. And in that general category is problem solving. People with ADHD nervous systems are world-class problem solvers. They are out-of-the-box thinkers. And so they can take a problem that has stumped everybody else, and they can come up with the right answer. And it's usually by this huge leap, just all of a sudden they go from the problem to the solution, and they have to work backwards from the solution to explain to themselves and everybody else why that's the right solution. And so people with ADHD work from the end to the beginning, whereas neurotypical people work from the beginning to the end.
That leap is tricky, right? That leap for me is one of the most frustrating things until I started doing consulting work and people just listened to the leap and were like, "Oh, that you must know what you're talking about. Clearly that's the thing." Yeah. For a long time, it was like, I would make this leap, I'd find the solution. And then people would want me to back it up and justify it and prove it. And I had no idea. I was just like, I just know this is right. Like, this is what's going to work.
Exactly.
I don't know how I got here, but can we just try it and I'll prove it to you by doing it as opposed to proving it to you by logicking backwards to where we started? And now that people just let me prove it by doing it, it's a lot easier because half the time I don't know what's in that gap.
When you think about what we pay out in the world of work, the big bucks for is the guy who can figure out the problem that stumped everybody else. We do not pay the big bucks the grunt who goes and implements that idea.
And that's where businesses need to be nicer to people with ADHD, right? I've had Absolutely. A few clients. One in particular is jumping to mind right now. He pulled their fat out of the fire for the company he worked with. He pulled their fat out of the fire so many times, but he couldn't get to a meeting on time. And so he was put on like corrective action because he was going to meetings late. He got a new manager and all of a sudden it was a big deal that he wasn't on time to meetings. And he's like, "I've saved this company millions and millions of dollars because I can look at the code that we're dealing with and crack it, figure out the problem and fix things."
In world record time.
Yeah, but he can't get to a meeting on time. And you get someone with power issues who's like, "You can't get the meeting on time."
Yeah.
You're in trouble.
There's a classic book on that called Clever, and it's written by two guys who are part of London School of Economics. It was the book of the year for Harvard University Business Press, I guess about 7 or 8 years ago. And it's about the fact that businesses need this small group of very clever problem solvers without whom the company can't grow, it can't solve its problems. The book is written for first and second line managers. And the bottom line of the book is leave these people alone. Do not micromanage them or they'll be with your competitor tomorrow.
And the book's called Clever. Is that what you said?
Clever. I wish I could come up with the guy's names that they wrote it, but it's from the Harvard University Business Press. The book is about exactly what you just said. The fourth thing that gets people engaged is urgency. Right at the do or die deadline, they are able to finally get engaged and turn out a huge amount of high quality work, but at the bleeding deadline.
This is something I talk about a lot in my workshops. One of the things that's tricky for folks with ADHD, right, is we're more engaged by the urgent thing and we're less engaged by the important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also not that great at planning as a result, right? Like the executive function stuff makes planning more difficult. we're not always going forward to the end, right? We'd rather go to the end and work backwards. So planning can be tricky for folks with ADHD unless we build that skill. And the metaphor I use for urgency is we're really good when like the light socket bursts into flames in the room. We'll go put that light socket out, right? But then the next one goes out and we'll run over there and put that light socket out. And all of these little fires that we're constantly putting out, they're full of dopamine. It's really engaging. As much as it's a little scary because there's a bunch of light sockets in this metaphor, it's also engaging and fun. And then when it's all done, we kind of are exhausted and we're like, oh, that was intense and hard. And what we don't do a lot of the time, metaphorically speaking, is rewire our house so these little fires don't happen anymore, because that's importance, that's planning, and it takes away the urgency. So some of us end up having more chaotic lives than we might want to or best for us because of how engaging those urgent moments are. And then that can lead to chaos and challenge.
Well, indeed, some people create urgency. They create catastrophes because they know that will help them get engaged and get started. Urgency is the ADHD equivalent of importance. You know, they're very, very similar. Urgency has that sense of, as you say, a dopamine rush that helps people really engage their nervous system. Urgency works just as well as importance does. The fifth one is what we call passion. Not only about one out of four people ever really attain this, and especially what gives your life purpose and meaning? What is it that makes them eager to get up and out of bed and go to work in the morning? Gives their life meaning and purpose? Most people don't have that. In fact, only about one out of four people do. But in the end, it's the most reliable and long-lasting. We sort of ran this by a bunch of people. We use the acronym NICA. It's novel, interesting, challenging, urgent, passion. Those are the five ways in which people with ADHD get engaged and get things done. Importance and rewards or consequences don't do it. So it's knowing what works and what doesn't, not losing a lot of time with the agony of being nagged by the importance of the task, or the boss thinks it's important, or the teacher thinks it's important. And so that's what I'm talking about with ADHD being really a second nervous system. People with ADHD, their nervous systems work perfectly well. They've never found anything they couldn't do. They just have to know the right circumstances, the right situation, that they were given the wrong owner's manual for their nervous system back in preschool. Everything they've been taught in a nurse typical school system and job doesn't work for them. Unlearning all the techniques that you see working perfectly well for the other 90% and not for you. I view ADHD as a second fully functional nervous system, but that works on its own set of rules, principles, techniques, whatever you want to call them. ADHD is really a second nervous system. And the trick is learning how to manage your nervous system.
I get that. So you're sort of saying my wife is neurotypical. I have ADHD. My wife has the interest, reward, consequence nervous system. I have the NICUP nervous system, the ADHD nervous system. And I see that. Like, I see how she and I are motivated differently. The way that plays out in our relationship and the way it's played out across our lives. I'm more comfortable taking risks than she is, because she's kind of averse to the consequence stuff. But a risk is bringing in the urgency. It's bringing in potentially problem solving, or maybe competition.
It's bringing in the now.
Right. Yeah.
Do it now.
And at the same time, my wife being averse to those risks, I early on didn't take those risks, because my interest was to keep her feeling safe and secure. And she is certainly a passion of mine. Right. And I want to make sure that I'm not causing her undue stress. And as a person with ADHD, I kind of felt like I did that enough. My struggles were significant enough that I'm already putting undue stress on her. Turned out the risk that I took, which was starting this business, ended up taking off a lot of the stress that was previously going on because my struggles are reduced. I got better at managing my ADHD as I learned about it. Then I started helping other people. And then all of a sudden, I was doing my passion, and that made everything else go more smoothly. We've had other challenges over the course of our relationship too, but that pivot ended up taking some of them away. And I'm not saying that's true for everyone, but I am kind of curious about, you mentioned the passion part is like 1 out of 4. What are the things that help people engage the passions of their lives more easily so that they can use that as a motivator? Have you noticed any patterns there?
People who are older than age 26, sounds a little grisly. We ask them to write their own obituary. What is it, when all is said and done, really mattered about your life and your being here? Not anybody else, but you. What gave your life purpose and meaning? And the next exercise is edit it down, you know, to what really matters. And then edit it down again. One, maybe two things that really gave your life meaning and purpose. Now, a lot of people say, well, isn't that important? Yeah, it is. What makes it work for people with ADHD is the emotional investment that they care tremendously about. And it's the caring that makes the difference. Mm-hmm. If they're under the age of 26, they just haven't had enough life experiences yet to really know what they want to do with their lives yet. And so for those folks, we use a different technique. We ask them to clear their minds, imagine the scene in their mind. They're now 85, sitting on the front porch with a lifelong friend. And they start the following sentence. You know, knowing all that I know now at the end of my life, if I were to have led my life without a single regret, I wish back in February of 2024, I had. And you finish the sentence. Again, a lot of people don't know what they desire, but just about everybody can tell you what they can regret. And interestingly enough, it's usually not regretting something that they did. It's regretting something they didn't do. And so that can be very helpful in finding out what is meaningful enough. Regret and desire are not really opposites. They're just the same thing, just one thing you did, one thing you didn't.
And kind of regret can resonate pretty significantly with folks who have ADHD, really anyone who's neurotypical or has a challenge of any sort, because you just mess up more. Regret can be a more familiar emotion to some of us, which isn't necessarily great, but that might be telling too. On the emotional component, one of the things I talk about with my clients is that we process information in two tiers, right? We process cognitively or intellectually, and we also process emotionally. And if we're communicating with people, we want to know, are they processing emotionally? Are they processing cognitively? Like, because different strategies of communication will work in different ways. But it's interesting that you brought that up, because when you said importance way back in the beginning of this interview, I remember thinking like, yeah, importance doesn't really do it for me. Kind of, but not really. But what does do it for me is significance. If something feels important, it's not the same as if it feels significant. And now I'm realizing that's because significance for me is emotionally charged and importance is more cognitively charged. And I am, of course, more motivated by the emotional weight of significance than the cognitive weight of importance. And that's so just an interesting observation.
Well, it's also significant to you as a unique individual. Importance can be anybody. It could be that the boss thinks it's important enough to him or her that they're willing to pay you to do it for them. I mean, that's what 80-85% of jobs are, is doing what the boss thinks is important, not that they're willing to pay you to do it. And that just doesn't help people with ADHD. It has to be significant. It has to be meaningful. They have to care about it. So if they can do those things, stand back, they'll do it better than anybody else.
So do you find that folks with ADHD that you work with, are they more successful being self-employed or in smaller companies where they have more, I don't know, wiggle room, for lack of a better term, they have more autonomy?
People with ADHD are wonderful entrepreneurs. If you can't do that, you have to think of yourself as being psychologically self-employed. Now, if you take this project and you're the boss of this project and you're the one who determines how it gets done, you have to be able to negotiate with your direct supervisor. Say, look, we both agree on this outcome. Let me do it my way, and I will get you that outcome with stars all over it. But you have to let me do it my way. For instance, people who are listening, one of the other questions I ask is, look back over your entire life. How do you know what you know? How did you learn what you know about your job? How did you learn what you know about relationships? How did you learn what it means to lead a good, honest life? How do you learn what it means to be a good parent for your ADHD kids so that they won't go through what you went through? How did you learn that? And most people with ADHD will sort of panic for the first minute or so. But ultimately, they come around to the answer of, what I know, I had to teach myself. You know, I'd listen to the lecture, take the book home, read the book. I'd take the problem apart, learn it in my way, then put it back together so I could put it on a neurotypical test. But I am, my education, I did myself. In terms of, you know, my personality and what I hold dear, I would see people that who I admired and wanted to be like, and I would take that piece and I'd learn how to do it myself. And most people with ADHD are self-made people. And they're very, very good self-made people, because ADHD does bring with it an awful lot of positives, very high IQs. You know, the average IQ of a person with ADHD is 125, all the IQ necessary to do anything you want. They're world-class problem solvers. Once they do engage, and once they hook into something, they can't be stopped. They have what Paul Winder referred to as cognitive dynamism. Most people with ADHD have two or three great ideas and a couple of new inventions every day. The problem is they don't go anywhere. They need an implementer finishing. What we do is we teach people how to get in the zone on demand, not, you know, by just happenstance or waiting long enough that it becomes urgent or something like that. And so we have people just carry around a pad of paper, or better still, some index cards. And it's when they're coming out of the zone that they recognize they were in the zone. When they're in the zone, they don't notice it. They and what they're doing become one. But it's when they're coming out, they go, wow, I just got a whole day's work done in about an hour and a half. Stop right then and there and write yourself a note. How'd you do it? How did you get in the zone and become superhuman? Was it because you were interested? And what in particular did you find fascinating? Was it because you were interested or challenged? And what brought out that competitive streak in you? And so on. At the end of a month, you'll have 20 different things that you know work for you, writing your own personal owner's manual. What really goes wrong for people with ADHD is that life hands them an importance-based owner's manual in preschool that never has a chance to work. You have to write your own personal owner's manual, and it will be personal to you. We tried writing a one-size-fits-all owner's manual, found out we couldn't. People are too different, first of all. And second of all, these techniques will work great for about 3 months. And then they get to be old hat, become boring and stuff like that. And you have to find a new one to take its place. And so most people walk around with about 20, 30 index cards in their pocket so that when they hit an important task that needs to be done by somebody, they can pull out these cards and say, okay, number 26 worked for something like this last time. I'm going to use 26, get engaged, get the project done, and then go have fun. I'm not going to lose all that time just spinning my wheels.
My friend Danny Donovan made a thing called the Anti-Planner. That is pretty much what you're describing. It's just a book full of all of these strategies for how to get started if you have ADHD. It's like almost like a recipe book. Like, it's not something you read cover to cover. You just crack it open to a random page and pick that. She has it organized based on how you're feeling. So you're feeling overwhelmed, or you're feeling stuck, or you're feeling bored, but you got to start. These are the strategies that may work most effectively given how you're feeling.
And that's where coaching really comes in, is in helping people learn their nervous system, and more specifically, learn what specific techniques, what situation helps you get engaged, get access to your abilities, and get things done. That's where coaching can do stuff that all those other non-medication-based therapies have no chance of working. This has a chance of working because it understands that people with ADHD are wired differently.
I want to flip this on its head for a second. I'm thinking of a client who I met with like an hour ago, actually. and this guy, he's great. But one of his pitfalls is he tries really hard to be overactivated and overproductive. So one of the things I'm working on him with is like, you're doing too much. Like you're going to burn yourself out. You're not able to give the kind of focus to the to stuff that you might want to or need to because you're doing so many things. And there's also guilt and shame that he has because understandably some of the smaller, less urgent, less significant stuff is falling off. And so he's not doing those things and now he feels bad. For most of this conversation, we've been talking about activating and starting. What are your thoughts on the folks who just are doing too many things because they, I don't know, are afraid of stopping and then never starting again? Or it's just how they stay engaged with the world.
Or as you say, turn it on its head. What's good enough? What's good enough for this job? It'll go ahead. It'll work on its own. And I can leave it and I can go on to the next problem. Again, it's sort of the obverse of importance. What's the thing that's the priority that means it goes to the first of the list and stuff like that? Well, this is the reverse of that. Is what tells you that it's over? It's good enough for government work. Are the priorities met? And I can now move on. Was the scope of work, was that completed? And if it was, move on to the next thing.
Yeah, and we can have trouble with that, we ADHD folks also, because so often we're told that what we did wasn't good enough, especially in school. We hear that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And then we just start feeling like nothing we do is ever good enough, and we're misjudging in the opposite direction and actually doing more than we need to be doing.
And a lot of that has to do with your own owner's manual. That is a part of the owner's manual. How to start, how to stop. That's what I'm doing with my time right now, is trying to finish up a book called Treating ADHD. A good portion of it's about medication, but the other half of it is about how to write your own owner's manual. And that takes up the other half of the book.
Well, I'd love to have you back when that's published.
I'd be happy to come and give myself a shameless plug.
That's what podcasts are for, really. and just being mindful of time, do you have any ending essentials that you'd like to share with our audience?
Accept yourself as you are. You have made it this far. In spite of not having any help or guidance until you found yourself a coach. No teacher understood your ADHD. Your parents didn't understand your ADHD. No boss understood your ADHD. You made it here all by yourself. So you deserve the credit. Now, you tend to focus on the things where you felt short for a while, and you feel guilty, you feel ashamed, and all that other nasty stuff. So you need to flip it and remember you did it. One of my favorite Dizzy Dean lines, I'm dating myself, was, it ain't bragging if you done it. You done it. You've made it this far. You survived this far. You're successful this far. Work from your strengths. Find out how you got this way and keep doing it.
Hey, you're still here. Nice. Thanks for staying focused all the way through. If you have any thoughts or questions about today's episode, feel free to email me at brendan@ADHDessentials.com. And don't forget to check out the website, ADHDessentials.com, and visit our Facebook community. I'm looking forward to talking to you again next week. In the meantime, keep focusing on improvement over perfection. 10% better is all you need.